We're going to look again at Isaiah tonight. We're going to go back and just talk a little bit about the background again. It's been a while since we did Isaiah, and really we're kind of continuing a story in Isaiah that I think is helpful to know the background and really helpful to remind ourselves of some of the lessons in Isaiah 7 and 8 as we continue from there in our discussion tonight. In Isaiah 7, you had a historical situation where Ahaz, the king of Judah, faced a two-nation coalition, the Syrians or Arameans, that's interchangeable names, and the nation of Israel, sometimes called Ephraim, had banded together. They'd invaded once, and Judah had repulsed them. They were on the verge of invading again, and Ahaz was scared to death. And that's when Isaiah came to him, and by the word of the Lord told him not to be afraid of those two nations. They were just blowing a lot of smoke, but there wasn't any fire. It wouldn't do any real damage. And that those nations would be destroyed before long, and they didn't have to worry about them. Just trust in the Lord. In fact, almost a challenge. You trust or else. If you don't put your faith and confidence in God, you won't last. And God was very merciful and patient with Ahaz. God is merciful and patient with people. And he offered to Ahaz to name a sign, any sign, and God would do it to give more proof that he could put his confidence in God in this threat. Well, Ahaz said, "Oh no, I wouldn't want to test the Lord." What that meant is he'd already made a decision to trust the Assyrians, and he didn't want to look bad by asking for a sign that came true, and he still didn't really trust God. He trusted the Assyrians. The Assyrians were a powerful empire. They had an excellent army. He could see them. They impressed him, and he decided to make a deal with the Assyrians for them to invade from the other direction, Syria and Israel, and wipe them out. And that was not a good idea. He wasn't supposed to be making agreements, covenants with other nations. And he wasn't trusting the Lord like God told him to. God said, "Don't worry about these two nations, just trust me." He decided Assyria was a better option. Well, you know what the result of that was. It worked. Trusting in Assyria. Assyria conquered Syria and Israel, and they kind of bitten off more than they could chew there. When Ahaz made the deal with Assyria, Assyria didn't bother to stop at the border between Israel and Judah. They flooded right on into Judah, and as he states it here in 8:8, reached up to the neck of Judah. Sennacherib, the Assyrian emperor, conquered 46 cities of Judah and came right up to Jerusalem and threatened Jerusalem to make them toast. And that was the unwise decision, the consequences of the unwise decision of Ahaz to trust Assyria and not trust God. Always works better to trust God. This is the warning that Isaiah is giving to Ahaz. But of course Ahaz doesn't listen, isn't interested in listening. The people of Judah are determined to put their faith and trust in an army they can see instead of a heavenly army that's invisible to them. So Isaiah has special messages to various groups. He has a message to these other nations that think that they can have their own way with his people. In Isaiah 8 now, and verse 9, "Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us." He is really here, Isaiah is, challenging the other nations to do the worst they can do. Put up your dukes and fight like a man. You know, arm yourselves, prepare yourselves, make your battle plan, and just try me. That's really God's message to them. Nothing devised against God and his people will stand. When the world chooses to assault God's own people, they're really choosing their own destruction. Because he says, you can gird yourself. In fact, go ahead. You know, almost like God saying, if he can say this respectfully, make my day. You know, just go ahead. You bring it on. I mean, do you reckon the Assyrian army or any other nation has ever put the fear into God? You know, have they ever made God a little insecure about whether or not he's tough enough to handle them? I mean, that's just a joke to even think about. So that's Isaiah's message to the other nation. They shouldn't get the big head and think suddenly that they can defeat the Lord. They can't. They will only go as far as the Lord allows them to. And you may remember a generation later when the Assyrians were knocking at Jerusalem's doorstep, God sent down an angel to do a night's work and managed to destroy the whole Assyrian army pretty much, and they decided to go back home. Wise decision, I would think. And then he's got a message, God does, for Isaiah and his followers. Look at verse 11. For thus the Lord spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, you are not to say it is a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy, and you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and he shall be your fear and he shall be your dread. The challenge for Isaiah and his disciples is not to think and act like the other people in the nation who are all worried about this conspiracy of Israel and Syria against them and all frantic about what are they going to do about it. It's hard to maintain your principles of faith and trust in God when the whole nation is against you. But that's what he's asking them to do. Don't say what they say. Don't think like they think. Don't you panic like they're panicking. Don't be afraid of the things that they're afraid of. They had to reject the paranoia of the nation and the panic talk and just put their trust in God. Fearing men is one of the most detrimental things we can do. When we begin to worry about what are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? I don't know what I've just got to lie, because if I don't lie, then what? Look what'll happen. I got to do this. And we panic because we don't think we have this under control. Well, we don't, and we won't no matter what we do, but God does. So don't fear the nations. Don't fear the people around you. Fear God. Let God be your fear and your dread. Make him the one that you're fearful of and that you're respecting. They must not lose their focus on God, even in crises. They need to see God's hand in every event that is occurring. So he's got a message for the nations, a message for Isaiah and his disciples, now a message for the Ahaz and his followers that were refusing to trust God. Verse 14, that he shall become a sanctuary, but to both the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over and a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Many will stumble over them, then they will fall and be broken, they will even be snared and caught. Here are the tragic consequences of Ahaz's decision not to trust God. God's going to end up being a stone and a rock that strikes them, they stumble over, a snare, a trap, they'll stumble, they'll fall, they'll be broken, they'll be snared, they'll be caught. God will bring down those in the nation like Ahaz who refuse to put their trust and confidence in him. You have to deal with the Lord. The Lord can be the Savior or the Judge, depending on whether or not we trust in him or whether or not we ignore him and put our faith in anything else. And here, to these two nations that were not trusting in him, God is going to bring them down because of their faithlessness. And then he turns back and really gives advice to Isaiah and his followers. And it's the same situation we're in. We're a remnant trusting in God in the midst of a world that does not. And so we need to listen to the message for Isaiah and his followers, because this is what we have to do. He says, bind up the testimony. This is verse 16. Bind up the testimony seal the law among my disciples. We need to rely on the testimony, the word, the law of the Lord. And I will wait for the Lord, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will even look eagerly for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. So here's this attitude of patiently waiting for and trusting in the Lord, learning his word and then depending on him, eagerly looking for him. Are we going to put our trust and our hope in the Lord or in one of the Assyrian emperors? That's the challenge. And Isaiah and his people, those who followed him, wait for the Lord, look to the Lord, trust in the Lord and in what the Lord has said. When they say to you, verse 19, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter. Should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? Now, you know what happens when people reject the Lord. You got to turn to something. You got to trust in something. You feel so insecure. And people who don't trust God grasp at some of the most ridiculous things to put their faith and confidence in, like here, the mediums and the spiritists. When you reject God, you turn to mostly anything. And the question is, just what would a dead man's spirit know about staying alive? You know, how valuable is it to talk to some spirit of somebody who hasn't managed to keep them alive? You know, and that's what he's saying. You know, should a people consult the dead on behalf of the living? Besides the fact that it ain't happening. But even if it were, if you could consult with the dead spirits, are they really the people you want to talk to and follow the advice of and so forth? And so he's telling Isaiah and his followers, don't listen to them when they want you to put your faith in the mediums and the spiritists and whatever other things they've dreamed up to put their faith and confidence in. Instead, verse 20, this is an awesome slogan. To the law and to the testimony. That's our word. To the law and to the testimony. Those are sufficient resources for the disciple of God. That's the yardstick of the truth. We need to appeal more to this verse. That's what we're doing. To the law and to the testimony. What does the Lord say? Oh, but I had this experience. I had this dream. I've been talking to this medium. Whatever. You know, I've done the financial analysis. We've run out the projections. Doesn't matter. To the law and to the testimony. God knows more than all the men in the world combined. We just base our faith and our trust on what the Lord says, on his law, on his word. That's what we appeal to. Look at what he continues to say. If they do not speak according to this word, it's because they have no dawn. Without the law and the testimony, it's all hopeless darkness. The light will never dawn. They will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished, and it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. Then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness. Isn't it interesting? What do people who reject God do in hard times? Get angry at God. Doesn't make any sense. You didn't want to trust him. You didn't turn to him. You didn't listen to him. You didn't do what God said, but you get in hard times and you're blaming God for it. That's exactly what they do. They're hard-pressed. They're in darkness. They're in anguish. They're famished. And they get angry and they curse their king and their God as if it was his fault. It's dark and depressing. They love the darkness. God will give them the darkness and a dark future. We've got the choice to put our trust in God, to the law and to the testimony, or to put our trust in all the charlatans and frauds and whatever people put their trust and reliance on, or ourselves if we want to. It's all darkness without the Lord. He is the only source of light. I really do think that we need to appeal more to verse 20, to the law and to the testimony. That's exactly the appeal that we need. But you know, the Lord is amazing. God, the Assyrians began to eat away at the nation of Israel. In 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 29, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ijon and Abel-Beth-Maacah and Genoa and Kadesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali. And he carried them captive to Assyria. That was the first chunk. Now, it's logical. The Assyrians, as the crow flies, they're east. But as the road goes, they're north. They have to come around the Fertile Crescent and come down from the north. So what parts did they bite off first? That very northernmost area of Israel. You know what we call that from a New Testament perspective? That was Galilee. That was the northernmost part. Up there by Naphtali, where those northern tribes had settled, over in Gilead on the right-hand side of the Jordan River. That's what the Assyrians bit off first. We'll now look at 9:1. If you might have a translation that numbers this differently, but for most of you it's 9:1 in Isaiah. But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. The first part of the country to be punished would be the first to receive the light. God is promising that one day the light would dawn up there in the north, up there around Zebulun and Naphtali, up there in the region that will be known as Galilee. And this passage is cited in Matthew 4. Where did Jesus first go and preach? Where was his homeland as far as where he lived? Was up there in Zebulun, Naphtali, up there in that land around the Sea of Galilee, and so forth. The area you would least think would receive the light, the farthest away from Jerusalem, kind of the backwoods and backwater of Israel, that's where God brought the light to dawn. When every human attempt to bring light fails, then the Lord himself will bring the light. Just as God expelled the darkness at creation by saying, let there be light, so he brought the light of Jesus first upon that northern region. He says in verse 3, you shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They will be glad in your presence as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak rolled in blood will be for burning fuel for the fire. And so he says, this is going to be a wonderful period of growth and multiplication for the nation, a time of wonderful joy, a time of victory. God's going to break the yoke of their oppressor. And he cites the battle of Midian. This is, when you're studying the Bible, you need to know everything else in the Bible for any particular thing you're studying. In this case, it helps if you remember the battle against the Midianites. You remember who fought against the Midianites? That was Gideon. And you know the part of Israel that was affected most by the Midianites and from which Gideon drew his army was exactly this part, Zebulun, Naphtali, those northern tribes. And so how appropriate that he cites God's giving the unexpected and incredible victory to Gideon and his ragtag army of 300 overmothered soldiers. You could call them soldiers armed with lanterns and trumpets. And so in the same way, God's going to give a great victory in this region again when the light dawns as Jesus comes into Galilee. Now, of course, he doesn't say as Jesus comes into Galilee. We're interpreting that in the light of the New Testament. But he does tell us the basis of this hope. So think about this. He says there's going to be this great light, verses 1 and 2, multiplication of the nation, gladness, joy, victory, break the yoke of the burden, staff on their shoulder, the rod of their oppressor, just a great smashing victory over the enemy. How is that going to happen, God? Verse 6, for a child will be born to us. All of this because of a child. You know, you would say, for a great and mighty warrior. No. All of these blessings for a child will be born to us. A son will be given to us. And the government will rest on his shoulders. He's going to become the king. And his name will be called. Now remember, I don't even know what Kyle or Laura mean. I never have worried about the meaning of names, and I'm like a lot of Americans are. But every time in the Bible, remember the meaning of the name. The name's not what you call somebody. The name reveals their nature. So his name will be, is saying, here's who he'll really be. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. That's who he's going to be. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. This child that will become king, look at who he is. He's the Wonderful Counselor. The true wisdom, as opposed to these false sources of wisdom they're trying to get with the mediums and the spiritists and wherever else. You want a wonderful counselor? Probably better not turn to some atheist who's got some degrees behind their name. Turn to the Lord. He's the Wonderful Counselor. He's a mighty God. Wait a minute. How can a child be a mighty God? And when Isaiah uses mighty God, that is big G God. Look at 10:21. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. Same exact expression. The mighty God in 10:21 means the mighty God. And the mighty God in 9:6 means the mighty God. This child is the mighty God. This whole idea of God coming in human form, that's in Isaiah and all through the Old Testament. That's not a big surprise. They already knew that if they were reading and thinking about it. But it's the question Jesus asked. Remember that after that day of questions, Jesus said, and how can the Son of David be David's Lord? Or in other words, how can David's Son be mighty God? Now, he could because he was both human and divine, but that's the question he's trying to get them to puzzle over and understand. The Old Testament taught that David's descendant would be mighty God. And not only that, eternal Father. Not limited in time. Remember what God told David? That one of his descendants would establish an everlasting kingdom. It would never end. Eternal Father. Prince of Peace. The greatness of this child who is coming would not be seen so much in war, but in the peace. The amazing peace that he brings. So we see so much about him. We see his qualifications here. We see his person, his power. There's going to be no end to the increase of his government or peace. He's going to reign on the throne of David over his kingdom to establish and uphold justice and righteousness. This is going to be a righteous, just king. Much different than rulers that they had known in the past and rulers that we know about. The character of this rule is going to be a righteous, just rule. Justice and righteousness are the foundation of the Lord's throne, and they're the foundation of this king's rule. For the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. This is not a work of man. This does not depend on any nation or its armies. This is the Lord. He will bring this to pass. So do you see the incredible insight and blessing in this passage in Isaiah? We've seen the emphasis. They need to trust the Lord. They need to turn to the law and to the testimony and rely on that and forget about all these quacks, religious teachers that are teaching them to trust in all kinds of things that have no light. It's all darkness and gloom. And that's what will happen to this nation that refused to trust in God until one day the light was going to dawn. The sun was going to rise up. First up in Galilee, of all places. And it was going to be a day of great growth and joy and victory, for a child will be born. The child who would become king. The child who would be the wonderful counselor, mighty God, eternal Father, Prince of Peace, who would have an everlasting kingdom, a kingdom of justice and righteousness, that the Lord will see to it is fulfilled. What a wonderful passage. So many rich things in Isaiah. And it makes you wonder how the Jews didn't see who Jesus was when he came. It wasn't because they hadn't had plenty of teaching in the prophets. We want to follow that king. I mean, we've got the choice. Everybody pretty much around us is following other things. They're following world religions, deviations from the truth, or worse. But if we want to be in God's kingdom, we look to the law and to the testimony. We rely and trust in God, and that's the appeal tonight. If you need to trust in the Lord, rely on His word and His testimony, come and submit to Him and live your life for Him. We'll be swimming upstream. Everybody else is going the other direction. But when we're with the Lord, we have the victory. Won't you come when we stand and sing?